Ben Greenman is an editor at The New Yorker, but in his other life, he's a regular on the McSweeney's literary circuit. His most recent book is Superworse, a genre-crossing novel published by Soft Skull. And genre-crossing is something that Ben Greenman knows a lot about. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to my show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Although I talk about Superworse, I could say, well, I'm not all that well. Superworse is the second in a trilogy. Can you tell us about the other two books?
Sure. The first book was called Superbad, and it was a hardback published by McSweeney's in 2001 that contained about 25 short pieces unlinked or very faintly linked to one another. Then this book, the current book, Superworse, is a novel composed of many of the same pieces, as well as some new, and there were many deletions, and there's a much stronger tissue linking them all, and it's branded as and is a novel.
But it's really chopped up and reconstituted Superbad?
It is. It's about 30% new, significant reorganization. A lot came out. There were topical musicals that were in the hardback that, for practical reasons as well as creative reasons, just didn't work, so they came out wholesale. And then there's going to be a third Superworst, which will be an audiobook, and then the trilogy will be put to bed, and I will retire from being funny.
So this is your funny trilogy.
It is. I mean, I'm working now on a much more conventional, serious novel, which will be out early next year from Nantalese Doubleday about a political candidate.
But I can't imagine Nantalese allowing you to do anything like this.
Like
or
this.
Doubleday. No. They're a traditional publisher.
At the time that I shopped this book, it's interesting, that the time that I shopped the first book, Superbad, my agent at the time and I went around, and people wanted to do one of two kinds of books. They either wanted to do a book of humor, or they wanted to do a book of serious stories. Anything that combined them, and certainly anything that aggressively combined them, was... It wasn't even necessarily that they were timid. They may have just thought it was creatively unsuccessful, but they didn't want to do it. It wasn't anything that they had interest in, really.
The cover credits Lawrence Onge with being the book's editor. It's rare for an editor to get cover credit on a novel.
It is. It's rare.
And he also wrote a foreword, a midword, and an afterword. I think this is the first time I've ever heard the word midword before.
He says he coined it. Uh-huh. In the midword, he takes credit. Right off, he says, I can read you the first sentence, first two sentences. First off, let me take credit where credit is due. I coined the word midword. So, yeah, he had a lot to do with this book.
Of course, you're from Brooklyn, and midword is a famous high school, so perhaps you were inspired.
Nothing to do with it. I'm a late Brooklyn arrival after high school.
Now, of course, Lawrence Onge, some readers will suspect, is a creation of Ben Greenman.
Some readers, some suspicious minds will. He's real or not, he's based on, when I was in graduate school, before I went back into journalism, I was going for a PhD in literature at Northwestern. And I had a professor, and I'm sure that if that person is listening, they will know who they are. I'm not going to identify them any further, who was a central casting, sort of a pretentious, overly aggressive, lazy professor. Nice guy, but not a good professor. And stuck in my mind for a long time because I did this stunt when I was in graduate school. You write a symposium paper, and you need three works. It was on a photography at the moment of death. And there's a Nabokov work, Imitation to Beheading, and a Borges story called The Secret Miracle, where right at the moment of execution, the people who are being executed see flashbulbs going off. Their death is being recorded, and it's a very charged moment where there's immortality. I needed a third work to write a paper. I couldn't find one, didn't want to, didn't like him, so I just wrote one. And I wrote about five paragraphs of it and faked it. It's called Snapshot. It's in here. I wrote five paragraphs, put it in the paper. He claimed to know the work. I made the guy up. I made his name up. Then I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. And then I went and wrote the entire piece, which is, it's now become in its various form. It was in Superbad and in Superworse. But he became Lawrence Onge. And Lawrence Onge is not real. I can tell that. But people frequently at readings, I thought about hiring a guy to play him.
I've always wondered about the guy that Daniel Defoe discovered to have written a couple of his books. I guess this is a literary tradition.
It is, and for me, it's a way of sort of making real. There's always this issue of influence and always this issue of whose ideas they are. When you write, especially when you write across genres, you have no choice but to use models. And I'm a formalist. Much of the humor in this comes from imitating forms. It's either imitating a menu form or a footnote form.
Or so, even record albums. You say that Superworse is a record album.
Yeah, in a way, I think that's true. It's a kind of concept record. But a lot of it has to do with exactly that. And to have a mentor, whether it's in your head or you know, across the desk from you, is very important. And I've never been good at being mentored. I have friends who were great at it, you know, in college and graduate school and their professional life. They somebody is good to them, they're good to the older person, and they work out a relationship. From a mix of, I don't know, arrogance, rudeness, and shyness, I'm just bad at it. It doesn't work for me.
So if someone tells me Ben Greenman is my protege, I'm to immediately assume he's lying.
Unless he's an actor I hired. I can't. I wish it were true in some ways, but no, it's a guy I made up, and I felt like giving him a lot of billing, because as the book went on, he had a lot to do with it.
You also write music reviews for The New Yorker, and you've written a song for the band One Ring Zero, who performed on our show live not all that long ago. How important is music to your writing?
Well, pop music's very important to me. In terms of the writing, at a point, the One Ring Zero project was interesting because that was sort of, they commissioned lyrics from a number of writers. For me in my writing, lyrics are important, I guess I'd have to say. There's the musicals that I mentioned earlier, which are in Superbad, were based on current events. There's one about the Florida election, one about Aileen Gonzalez, and they're imagined fake musicals with just little bits of lyrics that I thought were funny. I like, you know, rhyming works. I've always liked light verse. It is important. I mean, it's a way to get into people's heads. It's a way of striking up a rhythm. And I listen, you know, I mean, I listen to music all the time. It's not, it's become less important critically for me to sort of keep on top of music and follow it and be authoritative about it.
But I suspect the performance aspect is important to you because performance is plays a major role in a lot of what we're talking about. The third book in the trilogy is really a performance, and we'll get to that in a moment. Also, I gather you're judging a literary contest tonight at 8 p.m.
Excellent segue. I was just going to mention that because it's interesting you bring up performance. I've always thought of myself as a passable reader. I'm not bad. I'm not good. I've read with people who are really good. And this literary contest tonight, it's called Literary Upstarts, and it's downtown at 8 tonight at the Bagot Inn. And it's young writers. They perform on stage. They read their work. And then a number of people, I'm a judge, an editor at a publishing house is a judge. And we've done this before, and it was interesting. Some of them are great. Their work is okay, but they're great performers.
So this is somewhere between a slam and American Idol.
Yeah, it's more like American Idol. At the moment that we take over, it's more like American Idol.
So you'll be giving more credits to performance style than to literary worth?
I forget, it's 70-30, and I forget which is the 70, but we've been instructed to take both into account, yeah.
So, and that'll be at the Bagot Inn, 82 West 3rd Street. That's between Thompson and Sullivan. It's sponsored by Elle magazine. Have I taken care of business?
That's the plug. Excellent. It's at 8 o'clock? Is that true? Is that what you're
I think it says 8 o'clock,
yeah.
Yes. So let's talk about the third book in the trilogy,
okay.
Super Worst. Now, the idea of an audiobook is nothing new. Written books are released in audio format all the time, and there even have been a couple of original audiobooks. But is it technically a book if it doesn't involve words on a printed page?
Well, at this point in its third incarnation, it's been through a lot of changes. And my idea
is it the same book again?
I think it'll be different. And I think the idea as it stands, and people can go to bengreenman.com to see the details. I thought it would be interesting because one of the things about I'd like calling it Super Worst just because that's how it is in my mind, but it's, I guess, all of them. But the funny thing about this book is that there's no reader, professional or amateur, who likes the same two pieces. They're so diverse stylistically. They end up, in my mind, being all about the same kinds of issues. But there's no one who likes the same two pieces. Somebody says, oh, I love that piece that you wrote about blurbs, and I hate the long short story, and the next person's the opposite. So I thought that, and I've had a lot of, because initially McSweeney's was very good for this, I had a lot of interaction with readers through email, much more even than my understanding is on the big books. They just were very keyed into that scene and getting people to send an email. And so I thought it would be interesting to have readers read my short pieces and email them in to me. The technology is all in place now. You can do it in most of your computers. And I'll, you know, they'll authorize me to do it. They'll sign a release. And I will assemble an audiobook that's readers reading the work. Shorter pieces. I'll probably do the long ones. But I've had a couple people who send that in already through the website, and it looks like it's going to be, you know, at least interesting. It will also probably not be published, but for download, because that's where the technology is.
Now, is it important for the writers to be reading? Because some audiobooks are read aloud by professional actors, and except in a few instances, they usually are a lot easier to listen to.
Well, this was my point before. I mean, I'm on, you know, 20 minutes today, and that's taxing my limit in terms of how long I believe people are willing to listen to me. So an actor doesn't have that limitation. I agree with you. I'm always, even for readings, live readings, I'm always very taken aback to go and see authors read, because most of us are boring. We're you know, shy people who like words. Some aren't, but, there are pieces that I've written that are participatory or that have a slight visual aid, and those are usually funny. I tend to only read humor pieces when I read live, because the serious pieces are just killers. The proper response to a serious piece is hushed silence, and that's very difficult to distinguish from boredom on the part of the audience. And you, as a reader, it can just be a killer to have a sea of silent, odd faces or angry faces. You don't know the difference.
I don't think it's just you, Ben. I have done any number of live appearances with writers, and when you see Nadine Gordimer going for laughs and getting them, because she's a very smart and witty woman, you realize everybody wants to have that kind of response. You don't get the response unless you say something witty. Of course, you have done other things as well. You are really interested in genres, including ghostwriting. That's been one of the genres for Gene Simmons and Simon Cowell.
I have. I've
done the American Idol connection. I don't envy you working with Gene Simmons. He's been a guest on this show.
Oh, you've had him right here?
Yeah, he was here.
It was very interesting. I took a lot of time with him. We met over a number of months, and it was everything that you'd expect from a self-promoting rock star, but shameless about it. You know, a smart guy, but he has a persona, and the persona was very hard to crack, even over the course of writing the book. But it did well, and it fed into his growing empire of self-promotional materials.
Well, I will never kiss and make up with him. Do you think of writing a traditional novel for Doubleday as another genre to tackle?
It's a good question. I hope that no one there is listening when I say...
They're all listening at Doubleday.
Initially, but... yes. And as I did it, this was sort of the thing. I had started to shop around another book more like this, thinking, all right, well, I have a foothold. I've done it once. Let me see if now traditional publishing would like a more eccentric and more diverse collection. The response was better, but not great. And I had a short story last year. Actually, the last 2 years, I've been writing mostly serious pieces. There was a story in the Paris Review, a story in Zoetrope. And so it's been tending in that direction. But initially, yes, I thought, well, this is just a slightly longer experiment. A comedy piece might take a week. A serious piece might take a year, but it's a hat that you wear. As I've gotten into it, and I've had a very good experience with the editor and a very good experience with the process, it's changed a little bit. It's become something, I think it's become what it's supposed to be, which is something a little bit more, a little trickier and a little further under my skin and, you know, more real to me, and hopefully that works in the book. It's sort of a cliche about a longer piece, but when you sit with it for that long, your irony fades a bit.
You've also published interviews at The New Yorker, where you're an editor. Does it feel odd now being interviewed, or do you think... it's always struck me that I'm a pretty good interviewer because I know what an interviewer wants.
I started as a journalist years and years ago at a weekly paper in Miami, so I've always done both. It is strange. I mean, now, you know, stranger for me in a way is... This is a very easy experience because obviously you're experienced and good at your job. The stranger one are the young reporters, and this happened frequently with the first book, who call, and 80% of my brain just wanted to fix them. You know, redirect the question, say you're starting with the wrong premise. When it's a good, natural sort of conversational interview, it's familiar to me. But yeah, I mean, certainly there's that critical aspect to it when, you know, they send a kid to do the job.
Just one more thing. You've had a number of money-making schemes for McSweeney's.
I have.
Although, to be honest, none of them seem to be big moneymakers to me, like the name-changing service so that people can have funnier names to put on the tombstones, like
that one.
Duncan Disorderly. The cemetery will become a more cheerful place. So have people responded to any of them, or do they see them as a big April Fool's joke?
Well, I mean, the thing about McSweeney's, and I've moved both in a weird way past and back into that scene, as you said. I mean, when it started, my sense of humor was theirs. It wasn't like, I mean, there's sometimes a misperception that it's like The Onion or Saturday Night Live that we sit around in a writer's room. I think it was just a lot of people with similar senses of humor. Those pieces are, yeah, I mean, the conceptual art registry is the one that did better. I had some traffic on that. And the idea there was that I would think of all of these conceptual art pieces for a gallery, register them, and that people would license them from me when the bad artist in St. Louis needed, their thesis show was up and they hadn't thought of anything. And I got some traffic from that, and kids wanted to license it, and that was funny.
Well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've run out of time. All Ben right. Greenman is an editor at The New Yorker. His work has appeared there as well as in Nerve, McSweeney's, The Paris Review, Mississippi Review, Elysian Fields. He will be judging a literary contest tonight at 8 p.m. at the Bagot Inn, 82 West 3rd Street, between Thompson and Sullivan. Are people going to have to pay for that?
I don't think so. Don't quote me on it, but I don't think so.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.